And we'll be proceeding to our second oral argument here in moments. And while the attorneys are trading places, I'll note for the record, it's file A230558, State of Minnesota versus Sion Abdi Kusau, or Kuso. I ask counsel to correct my pronunciation if I'm far off, and even if I'm not far off. I'm joined Judges Wheelock and Kirk. I'm Judge Sleater presiding. We are recording and live streaming this proceeding. No other recording is allowed, is prohibited, but we will have that available, the audio, at least on the court's website within 24 hours on average. We do ask counsel to identify yourself for the record when you begin and keep an eye on the clock. There is an adjustment button, too, on the podium if you need it lower or higher. And so with those comments, counsel for appellant, looks like you're nearly ready. You may begin when ready.
May it please this august court, I am Daniel Adkins, and I rise for the appellant Sion Abdi Kusau in this matter. We have raised in brief 2 points in this criminal case, and we are concerned with a departure decision by the trial court here in Ramsey County. And I will start by saying counsel and I met this morning, and he promised to be kind to me, and I wish for this court to hold him to that. He's a gifted litigator, Your Honor. This case involves two aspects of a single decision by the trial court, and the decision was actually sort of bifurcated. And that was an act of incredible grace by the trial court, frankly, following on an act of grace by this court to permit me to delay the direct appeal. We then discussed a PCRA involving ineffective assistance of counsel, and this court permitted us to basically stop all of that and go back to ask the trial court to reconsider the decision on a departure of a durational basis. So I want to make it very clear. My brief is unclear. There's some suggestion that there might have been a dispositional departure that the court here could consider. Please don't do that. That's simply not the context that we're in. The issue is whether or not the offense conduct was onerous enough to require a finding of a felony, or whether the trial court in its discretion and this court in its appellate review could suggest that it was not as onerous and therefore could be a departure to a gross misdemeanor. That decision obviously is in the trial court. It has great discretion, and the standard for this court's review is abuse of discretion. We acknowledge it is a very high standard. I start from that premise. However, there's a factor that simply cannot be ignored, and that factor redounds around the error of trial counsel and the fact that the trial court and the state did not correct that error. There was an allegation of such importance. There was an accusation of rape out of Wisconsin in St. Croix County, two counties over from where this case was being litigated, and that accusation was live and impactful. In fact, the only place that case was still impacting as of January 23rd of 2023 was in the case that's now before this court, because it had been dismissed. That case was not dismissed based on a motion of the defense. It was not the court's decision sua sponte or, you know, considering interest of justice. It was the state's motion to dismiss that case because it couldn't be proven. But that case, that allegation, what more serious allegation than homicide, close to a rape allegation, was in the trial court's mind just as it's considering the first time, January 23rd, 2023, whether to depart durationally. Now, admittedly, a dispositional departure, you're talking then about the factors of the defendant. So you'd be looking at his personality. You'd be considering whether he's amenable to probation. The court wasn't doing that. It's considering onerousness. But of course, the court is a human. He's a human being. He's considering whether this person is worthy of a grant of grace, a departure downward. And he's also pretty confident that there's a rape case pending. But it wasn't. That very morning, hours before he made his decision to deny that grant of grace, that case was dismissed. But trial counsel, my predecessor in this case, did not research that matter. He admitted he was unaware of it. He did not inform the court that the case was dismissed. He did not ask for a continuance, even though the court acknowledged it hadn't even seen his departure memorandum. So I just need you to understand the context. You've got a trial court judge who's got a threat of violence case. It was initially a second-degree assault. That count was dismissed as part of the plea negotiations. He's now considering a threat of violence with a firearm. There's a carry permit and there's training, but we'll talk about that in a moment. But the point is, he's got a young man misbehaving, and he's about to decide whether that's a felony or a gross misdemeanor.
Counsel, aren't you making a bit much out of, you know, what it appears to just be an offhand remark about you have other cases pending? You know, when I read the transcript, when I look back at what was said, it does not seem that the Wisconsin case had as much impact as you assert.
That's a fair question, Your Honor. But what I'll suggest to you is that case not only was pending at the time in the judge's mind at the time he's making that decision, but more importantly, it was pending when the state was considering what negotiations to engage in. And I'm telling you, this was a gifted prosecutor. She's very thorough. She is very up to date on what's going on with her cases. When she says, I'm going to oppose your departure, she still thinks that case is pending. And it's not just sort of floating somewhere. It's in the pre-sentence investigation. It is very clearly highlighted on page 2 of that document as a pending matter. And it doesn't say criminal sexual conduct. It says rape. So my point is, there is not a trial judge alive. There's no prosecutor alive and no defender in this practice who would not think that was of consequence. We can't know just how much. It's a fair question. You think it's an offhand comment in that transcript, but it's still present in the calculation.
But the standard we're applying is an abuse of discretion, correct? And the court very clearly identifies and considers the offense that this young person did commit, and goes through the different factors and says, even considering all of this, I don't ultimately determine that this was any less onerous than another typical case of this nature.
That's an accurate statement of what the trial court submitted. That's an accurate statement of how that transcript rounds to its conclusion, and the ultimate decision is exactly as the court indicates. And frankly, that decision came down twice. I'll acknowledge that. And again, I have to say here, the graciousness that the trial court granted us to let us re-argue that is, and counsel called it extraordinary, and that's exactly right. But what I'll say to the court here, what I'll say to Your Honor is, with that misunderstanding, with that error, combined with a statement that the trial court made that I think is frankly completely erroneous, the word was brandishing. The brandishing was one of the key features for the court. He said, you brandished that weapon. Brandishing means displaying. It means taking it out from one's waist, taking it away from a concealed position and showing it and actually making it part of the conversation. But what the facts indicate is all he did was lift his shirt. He lifted his shirt. He didn't touch the firearm. He didn't put his hand on the trigger. He didn't show that it was loaded. He did not do the typical acts of brandishing. So the trial court characterized it in an exaggerated fashion and didn't realize that the case that was at least part of this calculation had been dismissed a few hours before. The other thing that the court didn't do, and this was breathtaking to me, he suggested on January 23rd, okay, are we ready to argue this orally? Because defense counsel, I don't see any memorandum from you. It had been filed 2 weeks prior. If you folks don't know, the e-filing system in Ramsey County is perilous. I don't rely on it anymore. I would email directly to counsel to make sure that it arrives on time. It didn't arrive when I was involved in the case, and the judge granted me a continuance. So what I'm saying is the die in this case was cast. The judge takes the bench. He thinks he's got a very limited argument being made orally, and he's convinced that there's a rape case pending two counties over. All of that was erroneous. And rather than continue it, he plowed through. And I don't blame His Honor. We have calendars in Ramsey County that would boggle the mind. He had a lot to do that day. And he thought he had a fairly straightforward question, as the court characterized. All I got to decide is whether this gun, whether this argument, whether these comments, I'm going to pop you, whether the threat that was made by the complainant, which was acknowledged, I'm going to have my brother kick your ass. I'm going to have my brother hurt you. She makes a suggestion that her brother is ganged up. This badinage back and forth seems bizarre. But the kids today, and I can't believe I'm using that phrase, the conversation between them is a failed a meetup. My client just misunderstood. Let's remember, he's a refugee. He was born in a refugee camp. He's in this country in refugee status prior to becoming a full citizen. In that context, with English as a second language, he was a moron. His conduct is indefensible. What he did to exaggerate the response is completely indefensible. It is a crime. What we're suggesting is it was always the gross misdemeanor version of a threat of violence. Remember, this court probably dealt with, in either in its prior iterations or prior jobs, or at this particular bench, with the terroristic threat concept. That was deemed to be too confusing, too inclusive. Threat of violence, the statute, the clarification from the legislature, I think was brilliant. I think it makes a lot of sense. We're not talking about terroristic threats. Always sounded like something greater than just a conversation between two people. It seemed greater than that, but it didn't have to be. This instance, this particular conversation, is a person saying, I want to meet up with you, I want to talk to you. She says, I'm not interested. It turns out she's 16 years old. That matters. That's of consequence. That's part of the facts, the law of the case. When she says, I'm going to have my boys put you out, I'm going to have you taken care of, and he responds, I'm going to pop you, and then leaves. Walks away. Doesn't chase her. Doesn't follow her. That's not part of the facts of the case. It's verified to not be the case. He simply fails at an introduction. He was a moron. And he left. And let's remember, contextually, so talking about whether it was onerous or not, he has the carry permit. He has trained in safety. He understands the rules about having that firearm. He is not under the influence. He is not on drugs. He is operating lawfully. The state can't charge him with ineligible possession of a firearm because it was legal to have that firearm where it was. Those are factors that matter in terms of onerousness. That is the argument that we made, and the trial court pushed past all that.
Don't those factors actually make it more onerous? He knows how to use it. That's what the training, perhaps. He wasn't under the influence, so he did this with a clear mind. I guess I'm not sure that those make it less onerous.
I think that's a fair point, that what is your training worth if you're willing to do this? But you've got to put it in the context of he just was threatened. That was a fact that the judge found. The trial court found that a threat was communicated to him and that his response was inappropriate, was outsized. Again, the difference between the sanction that he received and the sanction we sought is 2 days. It's 2 days. It's a year and a day for the felony. It's 364 days maximum for the gross. But the felony, that scarlet letter, that matters. The court understands. That's why we fight so hard on these points. That's why we negotiate so carefully. But my point is, with a lawyer acting ineffectively, not even pulling up WCCA, the Wisconsin version of AmCRO, not even spending 30 seconds to find out what's the status of this rape case while he's making these arguments. So as we talk about this, Your Honor, my point is we can't know to what extent the trial court was influenced by something that should not have been present.
Isn't it
a fact that was wrong.
By the resentencing, though, the court was informed. So the court knew that it had been dismissed.
Fair point. That's why I suggested, and it's in our brief, the die was cast. The point is, when he takes the bench, when that judge stares just as you are to me now, when the judge is in that position making that decision, it was in his mind. He had considered at least most of the arguments that counsel had made, but very quickly as he reads through his memorandum on the bench, he didn't even take it into chambers. He just moved through. The die was cast. When I'm talking to that judge a year later, a year of perfect conduct on the part of my client, when I'm trying to convince him that this kid is worth that grant of grace, and I came up with a creative way to do that. I think there's some reference to that in the briefs. I can describe that if the court has questions. But as we're making those arguments, I could not resonate with that judge because he had already decided that departure had been denied and was only going to be denied again. So my point is, you cannot know, you can't understand here now to what extent it impacted him. We have to start again. We have to remand for those purposes. We have to remand so that the defendant has an opportunity with counsel who's fully informed and with accurate facts can present to the court, either in the context of a sentencing or what you would call a new trial. There is no trial here. This will be negotiated. But again, my point is, a prosecutor who's talented is not going to ignore the what we would call relevant conduct. If it was a federal case, they'd sentence based on that, for crying out loud. You don't do that here, thank goodness. But it matters. It's the same sort of aggressive conduct. It's the same sort of conduct with a woman, in fact. It's the same sort of misguided decision-making that would alarm you. But it turns out it wasn't of relevance. It was dismissed. That case should never have resonated. The only place it resonates now is here. And that is untoward. That is unfair. And in the latter portion of our brief, there are two aspects of the latter portion, one of which you can ignore. Like I said, any reference to a dispositional departure, that is an error. That's not something I want this court to consider.
But counsel, isn't this kind of a different way of getting to a dispositional departure? Because you're taking a felony and making it a gross misdemeanor. And under Kratzer, in other cases, it seems like the state has the right to get a conviction for the level of charge they've charged.
I wouldn't call it a right. I understand where the court is going with that. I don't think there's a right on the part of the state. There's certainly an expectation. And I think that there is and the standards that apply make it very difficult to overturn a court's decision to deny that grant. That's fair to say. But again, when you do have all of the dispositional factors, I think, I wish it were the case that some mitigation would leak into the duration. I think the court understands what I'm saying. And I'm not saying that there's a backdoor. You don't have the opportunity to sort of ignore those precedents. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is you had an individual who was very remorseful, who was very clear at his allocution that he was remorseful, that he accepted accountability. He did that through the PSI. He wouldn't have been a candidate in any way for a durational departure if those things weren't the case. That's my point, is that it is something that the court considers. Without those, you have no chance. With those, and an argument about onerousness. And so I appreciate the court's question. Yes, having the permit should make you smarter, but having the permit makes the fact that the gun is on you because you're concerned for your safety, is it in fact itself legal? That is of a moment. It matters. It's not a separate crime to have the firearm. He was not under the influence with the firearm, which is a crime I run into all the time. I literally lecture on these points for the people that are going through gun safety training to please God, leave your gun home when you're going to be drinking. We see what happens, the carnage that ensues. He didn't do any of those things. So my point is, if it's a close call on onerousness, and guess who said it was a close call? The trial court did twice. He said it's a hard decision on the first time. The second time he said, Mr. Atkins, you've made me think very hard about this. This is a very difficult decision. I think that resonates with this court, or it should, to say that we are that close. If the call is that close and the dispositional factors are all more or less in favor of the defendant, why are we saying that we're going to permit this mistake, this case that was dismissed, to resonate at all? It had to have some impact. The court brought it up. You've indicated, Your Honor, that it was a sort of a throwaway statement, but nobody triggered it. Nobody suggested it. It's sua sponte. And I believe it's a revelation that the court was, in fact, thinking very carefully about that among all of the factors. And he was misinformed. It's not his fault. It's not his job to go on WCCA. There's a person in that courtroom who had a solemn duty to make sure that that information was accurate, and he didn't do it. That's why he was ineffective. One quick point before my time expires. This court will tell us we don't use Strickland, and we don't consider strategic trial decisions or strategic decisions on behalf of the defendant. There is no strategy involved. This is simply a mistake. There's no benefit. There's no trade. I didn't call that witness because I was afraid of the impact of the testimony. He just didn't know. And it was his job to know, and it was his job to inform the state, and you better believe he had to inform the court. He didn't do that, and that is why we are, as passionately as I am, barking about this. And I will reserve my time to rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach, and when ready, identify yourself and begin.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Counsel, I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker, appearing for the state. Your Honors, I don't have a lot to add that is not in my brief, but I would offer some comments by way of summary and response. Because of the relatively unusual circumstances here, appellant has received two independent sentencing hearings with two different attorneys. At both hearings, he moved for a durational departure. And both times, Judge Yang denied the motion for the same reasons. There's been some suggestion that Judge Yang didn't do his due diligence in making those decisions. That's just not reflected in the record. The court listened to all of the arguments and was clearly familiar with the case. The court denied the motions because appellant showed the victim a gun in his waistband and he threatened to kill her. That is certainly a threats of violence case, and I would argue a serious threat of violence case compared to most other threats of violence cases. He has a firearm. Whether or not he brandished it, the court's characterization of that, there's no question that he showed a firearm and threatened to kill the victim. Counsel suggests that he was feeling threatened by the victim. There's just nothing in the record to suggest that. Judge Yang said that there was some conversation that led to her threatening to call her brother. She was clearly being threatened. It's not surprising that she would call for help. But, I mean, to suggest that that somehow justifies or explains the conduct is a stretch on this record. And Judge Yang certainly did not buy it. So the victim rebuked appellant's advances, and that was his conduct. Appellant's actions are not significantly less serious than the typical threats of violence. As to appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim pertaining to counsel's performance at his first sentencing, this claim does not merit relief for at least three reasons. First, the dismissed Wisconsin case had no legal or factual bearing on Judge Yang's consideration of the departure motion during the first hearing. It just didn't matter. Judge Yang mentioned it when he was talking to the defendant about his probationary obligations. That's all it was. It did not play into the decision. There's no record support for that. The second reason is that Judge Yang simply did not rely on that case in denying the departure motion. The record is clear on that. The third reason is that the second sentencing hearing, the resentencing hearing, established that even if counsel had failed to investigate and advise the sentencing court about the dismissed Wisconsin case, it didn't affect the outcome. Everybody knew about the dismissed case at the time of the resentencing, including Judge Yang, and it simply didn't affect the outcome. There can be no establishment. Even if you meet the performance prong of Strickland, there's no way you can meet the prejudice prong because it didn't affect the outcome, and it shouldn't have affected the outcome because it's not the parameters of the evaluation that the trial court was making in considering the durational departure motion. And so I would ask this court to not remand for an ineffective assistance of counsel evidentiary hearing for two reasons. First, they've had the opportunity for that hearing and they didn't take it during the stay of this appeal. Second, there is no record that could be created on remand that would merit a reversal for ineffective assistance of counsel for the reasons that have been explained in my brief. The record is clear that he is not entitled to relief on either prong, and certainly not the prejudice prong, even if they could establish that counsel was ineffective for failing to advise.
Counsel, does appear that Judge Yang, both because he did the unique thing of scheduling a resentencing and made some comments regarding the time he spent considering it, so forth, that he did consider it a close, at least in his, I'm assuming from his opinion, closer than perhaps typical durational departure case. What would you agree with that characterization, and what part of the facts do you agree that, I mean, notwithstanding obviously your point you made today that the judge thought it was a closer than normal such motion?
Your Honor, I don't think the court thought that. I would add that a big part of the reason that appellant got his resentencing is because the state agreed to it. The state agreed to say, yeah, let's have this resentenced. I was part of that conversation. Let's flesh these issues out and have a complete record for the appeal. And Judge Yang went along with that agreement, but I think it's not accurate to say that Judge Yang allowed a resentencing because he thought it was a close case. We just agreed to do it because it seemed to be in the interest of justice, and let's flesh out these, make a record for the appeal. And so that's what we did.
Thank you.
Counsel, was your team or whatever thinking about the Kratzer issue I brought up? I know in the plea agreement you reserved or indicated you would object to the durational departure, which would suggest if Kratzer applied, then that there was no point in going any further. But what was your position on that?
Your Honor, I can't speak to the prosecutor's position on that because I don't know specifically. It wasn't raised in this appeal, so I apologize. I can't really speak to that other than to say that the prosecutor was intent on opposing any sort of departure motion here. And frankly, it had nothing to do with the Wisconsin case. It had to do with the conduct that appellant exhibited in this case. And if there are no further questions, I would ask that you affirm Judge Yang's sentencing order and the conviction, and I thank you very much for your time.
Very well, thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you now have, or appellant, excuse me, 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. He didn't keep his promise, Your Honor. He promised to be kind. I'm going to touch on that point that the court just made. In fact, the court, Judge Yang, both in the initial hearing when announcing his decision, indicated that it was a tough decision. He indicated that there were factors that leaned in both directions. And then he praised me, and that's why I remember it so clearly, because he said, Mr. Atkins, I appreciate your efforts, and they were creative. And he said, this is a tough decision. And that's in the transcript. That's actually in the court's record. And I'm not suggesting that that's the reason that he gave us the second crack, if you will. But I will indicate that as he thought about these, as we were in the courtroom, as we're arguing, and again, he had two opportunities to hear victim impact. And the court knows how powerful those can be. They are there for a reason. The victim impact in this case, that young lady submitted a letter, and it was read to the court in the second hearing as well. So it matters. In addition, he was considering the arguments that we were making that, you can't have been completely fair because you had this mistake, you had this case floating, and in addition, we believe that we've proven that this is less onerous. So back to the factors that Your Honor and I were discussing. He did say it was a tough decision, and I do think that that resonates here. It should resonate here. It is a close enough call. And I'll say one more thing. Counsel was not unfair in this, but I think there's a misstatement there. We did not have a hearing directly before the trial court about ineffective assistance of counsel because this court, quite understandably, didn't grant us further leave to do that. Because of the unique nature of this case, we didn't have that opportunity. We would have that opportunity if this court remands the matter. So that is one way to sort of solve or you know, resolve this particular issue, is send us back to try to convince Judge Yang that there was, in fact, ineffective assistance. The proposal that I had for Judge Yang was that he bifurcate sentencing on the February date that we had this year to essentially say, today you're a felon. It's essentially like a stay of imposition. Today you're a felon. I will see you at 1 month prior to the termination of your probation, and we will then discuss whether a departure is appropriate. It has been done. It's a bit unusual. It's fairly common in Wisconsin. That's how they set up expungements over there. But I proposed that to him. He did carefully consider that. What I'm suggesting is the court was doing everything it could to grant the relief that we were seeking. He just couldn't get there with that victim impact statement, with the arguments that counsel's partner was making or counsel's colleague was making. And I understand that. But what I'm suggesting is the die had been cast for over a year because of the mistake that counsel made, which was so easily avoidable. There's no strategic advantage to not checking on a case two counties away, to not asking for a continuance, to find out what's happening in that case. Your Honors, it is my practice when there are multiple cases with other attorneys, I have them on speed dial. I make sure I know what's going on in all cases because they do reverberate with one another. There's not a judge alive that doesn't consider all of the conduct that you're accused of, that doesn't consider how many times you're in court or for what reason. This is not a case of disorderly conduct in Wisconsin. It is rape. It is the allegation that's second most serious that can be laid. And it was dismissed. It matters. That's my point, Your Honor.
I still am not sure how you get around the fact that Judge Yang knew that at the second hearing.
The point that I'm saying there is that the die was cast. He had already decided that this young man...
But then you're asking us to agree with you that Judge Yang did not actually take into consideration that piece of information.
I'm suggesting that the record is simply too tangled because of the mistake that was made and because of the rush that was involved in the first denial of the departure, that the departure could not have been fairly considered. I understand it's a very, I'm threading a needle, that's fair to say. And I don't expect that the court will find that an easy decision to make, but what we're suggesting is the impact on this young man's life is significant enough, is sufficient enough for you to make that, for you to reach that finding. And again, you don't have to decide that the decision was inappropriate or insupportable or an abuse of discretion. You can remand so that I have an opportunity to talk to Judge Yang about the ineffectiveness of that counsel. And Judge Yang may recuse himself. It is possible that one of the things he might do to make sure there's a clear record on the final decision is that another judge, not tainted by that case in Wisconsin, not affected by any of the prior aspects of this record, that could be a solution to this matter. But that's something I'd have to take up at the district court level. But what this court did by creating the stay and by denying that second stay, which, again, it's logical, makes perfect sense to get the case moving, that's why we don't have a record before you for a trial court saying it's either ineffective assistance or not. That's why we're talking about Strickland, we're talking about Kratzer, we're talking about those prongs, rather than the district court giving you a first decision, which is normally would normally be the case. Obviously, I'd have asked for habeas or PCRA relief first and foremost and had that conversation. And I'll tell you what I would have done. My colleague, John Archigo, who was my predecessor in this file, was a very gifted lawyer. I would have subpoenaed him, and I would have had him come and talk about why that didn't happen. I suspect what he did was he ignored it, hoping it would not come back up. But how can you do that when it's in the PSI? How can you do that when your counsel has been negotiating with you, knowing that that case exists? There are elephants you can avoid, but some just keep roaring, and that's the point that we're making. I see that my time has expired, and I appreciate this court's incredible grace with the defendant. We do appreciate that.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing and answers to any questions we had today. We will take the matter under advisement, be issuing an opinion within 90 days. Have a good day. Thank you.